build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects. Candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
So welcome back to another episode of Culture Architects. This is a very special episode, not that they all aren't, but this is particularly special because many people know that in the talks that I give and even in my books, I often start a talk by talking about high school, public high school sports dynasties. And in particular, I always like to start with my own hometown of Moorestown, New Jersey, and in particular, the women's lacrosse program. When the women's lacrosse program is legendary for having won so many championships and built such a successful culture. And I talk about public high school sports dynasties because I find them interesting because they face two interesting challenges. One is that you know, in a public high school, for the most part, you're not able to recruit. You're just stuck with whoever happens to be in your town. And secondly, you're turning over your roster every year. And so if you can manage to have an extended period of success, there's something else going on there, and it's largely the culture that's built in those teams. And so I always talk about the women's lacrosse team in Moorestown, New Jersey. Well, today we have as guests the coaches, and it's a husband-wife pair, Deanna Knobloch and Casey Knobloch, who together coached for many, many years that women's lacrosse team in Moorestown. They are legendary. Deanna took over the program in 1992, coached it for 27 seasons, the last 18 to 20 of it, with Casey joining her. And Deanna was the winningest coach in lacrosse history in the state of New Jersey. She won 500, her teams won 580 games, something like 15 or 16 or 17 state championships, 7 tournament of championship titles. Deanna was named South Jersey Coach of the Year a lot of times. She was inducted into the New Jersey Lacrosse Hall of Fame. They went through one stretch, believe it or not, where they won 228 consecutive games against New Jersey competition. I mean, we're talking legendary. And so this is a wonderful opportunity to get to understand more about how Deanna and Casey did this, and in particular, the culture they built. So welcome, Deanna and Casey. So thrilled to have you on the podcast.
Thank you, David. Thank you for having us. We're honored to be here.
Well, it's a great chance to learn from you. So let's go back for our audience, just a little bit of history. So Deanna, you played in Moorestown, correct, on the lacrosse team?
I did. Played in the late 80s, graduated in 1986.
Okay. And then after college, came back. Had you always known you wanted to coach lacrosse, or like, how did that happen?
No. Mm-hmm. I went into college. I didn't even know what I wanted to do. I ended up being very indecisive, changing my major 4 times. And when it came down to it, I looked back over my like years of schooling, what I loved the most about it. And I always loved phys ed. You know, I remember all my phys ed teachers. So I said, that's it. I'm going to go on. I'm going to become a phys ed teacher. And with that, the coaching position fell on my hand because when I was doing my student teaching at West Windsor Plainsboro, my senior year of college, the middle school team started and they needed a coach. And I was there and I took over. It was like 7th and 8th grade. There was probably like 80 girls on the team.
Wow.
And that was my first coaching experience.
And so was that in West Windsor or was that back here in Moorestown?
That was at West Windsor.
Okay, got it. And then when did the position open up in Moorestown?
So my high school coach, Lynn Schilling, was moving on up to vice principal and she knew I was graduating. So she basically handpicked me to take over for her. And, you know, as soon as I graduated, they brought me in for an interview and I not only got her teaching position, but the varsity position as well.
Right. So as you took over that program, there was already, I mean, you had this legendary success, but as I recall, because for our audience sake, I went to the same high school. And I remember that the women's lacrosse team for years, long before that, was always fantastic. I met a lot of my classmates were lacrosse players. I remember that. So you took over a program already was successful. Did you feel any pressure about, this is you know, legendary program I'm taking over. I can't let this down. What did you feel about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I was only 22 years old. You know, uh-huh. I was young. I really didn't have any idea what I was getting into, but I did know I was taking over a very successful program. The 2 years prior to me taking over, they were state champions. Wow. When I had played there, we never made it to that final game. But I took over in 1991 and, you know, they were state champions in 89 and 90. So I knew I was taking over a program and it was going to be my job to continue. I mean, Lynn Schilling, like I said, handpicked me. So I had to live up to her expectations. And I'm, you know, I don't recall a lot about that season, but I'm certain that 22 years old, I had really no idea what I was doing and just knew that my job was to win, to keep winning.
Uh-huh. So as you took over that program, you're 22 years old, you take over this winning program, you've got to keep this going. Were there certain traditions that you remember that you had, you know, on the team? This is the way we did certain things, whether it was practice or games, that you made sure you were, you wanted to continue, or were the things you said, we got to start changing these?
So both. Mm-hmm. When I took over, Lynn had put all the girls in shorts and tank tops. Like she was a pioneer of the sport back then. She changed things. She did things on her own that were unheard of back then. You know, everybody wore kilts and collared shirts. She put the girls in tank tops and shorts. Everybody used a wood stick back then. You know, I didn't use it in college. She started using the molded head stick way back then, before it was even, you know, popular.
Mm-hmm.
So, but when I came in, my mindset was, no, we're gonna, you know, be traditional. Where I put them back in the kilts and the, and the collared shirts. I said, no molded head sticks. We're staying with wood because that's what I played with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I started to change some of the defense a little bit to what I played throughout college.
Mm-hmm.
And she had back then implemented what was then the zone defense, which nobody played a zone defense. And I took that away.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, by the end of that year, we brought it back in because I sat down with her at some point and said, okay, it's not working. And she said, it's because you're not playing that zone defense. So I put it back in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was... Let's be honest. I was scared of her. She was my coach. You know, I revered her. She was a very stern woman. Didn't like to laugh or smile too much. You know, she was very, this is what's got to be done. And like I said, at 22 years old, I kind of listened. Uh-huh. So at that point I did the same, you know, schematics on the field, but I did do some of my own implementations with the changing of the uniforms and back to those wood sticks.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the, I'm going to call them rituals. I talk a lot about rituals in my business, and I think of rituals as just routines, things that we do, the way that you line up for practice, the way that you get on the bus, the way that you do things after a game. Are there certain routines and rituals that you grew up with in the sport that you then adopted or changed? What are some of the things that the team did that this is the way we do things on our team?
The biggest thing from when I was in high school, mm-hmm. I would have to say the cheering.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a lot of cheers, you know, we cheered the entire game.
Hmm.
And I remember back then, even the JV and varsity, we all stayed together. You know, there's a lot of teams where varsity plays and then they leave mm-hmm. and the JV plays. For the program when I played, everybody was one team. And that continued when I took over as well. And I think that's a really important part of our program is that it was one big family mm-hmm. from freshman all the way on up to varsity. You know, we were always all together. But the cheers back then, we definitely kept going. And I would say, you know, over the 27 years that I was coaching, we definitely developed a lot more rituals along the way. Like so many of them now that when the new coach took over, it was like, you don't really need to do all those because there was just so many.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, there was definitely a lot of them.
So give us an example of just a few of the rituals. What were some of the things that you did?
The number 51. That, you know, that was a uniform shirt that was passed on down through the years.
Hmm.
That started back in 2000. And it was just became this, you know, number of representation of Morristown girls lacrosse.
And who would get that each year? Is that like the captain of the team or?
Well, it was handpicked by the girl who wore it, basically.
Wow.
And it, you know, people thought maybe it was the best player coming back, but it was the person who embodied Morristown girls across the most, who believed in it, who bled black and gold, who would do anything for the program.
Mm.
So, you know, that was handpicked from the previous girl, you know, with some input from myself.
Wow.
But
typically, however, she was certainly one of the best, if not the right. best player.
But it was more a representation of, as you said, what women's lacrosse was about, more so than just being the best player.
Absolutely. How about number 12 too? Defense.
Was it 12? No.
So what was number 12?
What was the defensive number?
The defense was an unspoken. We can't remember the number right now, but that was an unspoken cast down. Okay. Like that started because I think the defense was angry about that 51 wasn't included.
Okay.
whatever reason.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, they started their own little thing with the 21. Is it 21?
I'm sorry I brought it up.
No, it's all right. So
now we sound, we don't know what we're talking about, but so yeah, so the number 51, the squeeze, which is a locker room tradition that we would do in our locker room before a really big game where the girls got in an all big circle and we would hold hands and I would give some kind of a speech and I would start the squeeze to my left and everybody had their eyes closed. And you know, you were like picturing the field or picturing the game or picturing winning. And then the squeeze would get passed all the way down. When it got back to me, we would do our cheer. And that was, you know, only done on certain occasions. But that squeeze, I didn't develop that myself. That's something we did in college. Mm-hmm. That's something I took from my college program.
But those are meaningful, those kinds of rituals.
Yeah, I mean, you ask a Morrison Girls lacrosse player, they'll know what the squeeze is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think if you ask any Trenton State College TCNJ player, they will know what the squeeze is because I'm pretty certain they still do it now.
Mm-hmm. I had as a guest on this podcast Matt Daugherty, and Matt Daugherty was the coach of the UNC men's basketball team that played at UNC. And one of the things he talked about that I thought was interesting was that at UNC, and I'm going to ask you about this as it relates to Moorestown, is that at UNC, when you played there, you were a UNC player for life, that you were part of the family, and you always had a role, and that it led to players coming back, whether they coached there or not, but they came back and they helped out and they supported. And it was like you joined a family for the rest of your life. I get a little bit of a sense of that with Moorestown Women's Lacrosse. Is that true? And if so, how did you create that?
Family is a huge part of our program. Mm-hmm. You know, it was always, everything was developed around the family. Like I said, we never separated. When we had psych parties before, the night before games, it wasn't just the varsity. It was the whole program. Well, not freshmen. Freshmen was definitely a little bit separate when it came to games. But, you know, I wanted them all to feel an equal part of this program. Mm-hmm. That one team wasn't better than the next. One player wasn't more important than another. Everybody was part of this family and everybody had a role on it. You know, and I think that was one of our strongest parts of this program was that we worked really hard at developing that bond between all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that, you know, the girls that have gone on to graduate, they still feel a part of the family, whether they're 10 years out or 20 years out. I mean, I know I do, and I graduated back in 86.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One of the traditions typically every year as we were going into the playoffs, and the former Morrison Girls lacrosse alum who went on to play in college, when their season was over, they would come back to our practices and participate in the practices to help the girls get ready, get prepared for the upcoming state playoff games.
Mm.
They would obviously steel sharpen steel. You would have these Division I players coming back and saying, hey, I'm a former player. I played here 5 years ago, 10 years ago. And they would talk about their experiences, but they'd also get a chance to play against the girls during the practices. And it would certainly prepare these kids for the opponent that was coming up.
I can see how that would be both physically a benefit and also emotionally, just to feel like, wow, they're sharing their wisdom.
Another thing that we did, the alumni, and many occasions we either had them write letters to the team and we would read it to the whole team.
Wow.
You know, their experiences, what they thought about Morrison Girls Lacrosse, or maybe there was a big game coming up and, you know, what they need to do to prepare and to win. You know, mm-hmm. there was, like I said, a lot of different traditions. So that was another one of them where the alumni were always included,
wow.
You know, with letters or whatever it was, phone calls, text messages.
That had to be meaningful to a high school student.
Yeah, because those were the girls they looked up to, you know, and that's why the current girls, they were playing for those girls before them, you know, to keep the tradition going.
So how did there must have been, if I'm one of those girls and I joined this team, I'm sure there's excitement about all this, obviously, but there's also got to be some pressure about, I'm sure when you had a 228 game winning streak, there was a lot of pressure there. How did you help them deal with the pressure they felt about the legacy that they needed to uphold?
Go for it.
Okay. One of the things that we never talked about was the streak, whatever the streak was at the time, because there were several streaks along this 27-year span. I mean, mm-hmm. we had, that's the 228 game victories, straight victories against New Jersey teams. But we also had several consecutive streaks against teams from all over the country that went into the 70s and the 80s.
Wow.
And the one thing we never talked about as coaches was maintaining that streak. Mm-hmm. It was always about the very next game.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I think, you know, pressure is a privilege, as they say. And a lot of these girls looked at this as, hey, we get to play against the best competition high school wise in the country on a consistent basis. And we don't want to be the ones that are going to let the program down. Mm-hmm. They looked at it as a program. They didn't want to not only let their teammates down, but they didn't want to let the program down. You know, the kids that came before and the kids that would soon come after them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, while it was a lot of pressure, and we came to find out from a lot of the parents how much pressure there was. And then later, as our daughter played for us, we saw that pressure firsthand. But we never talked about it. We never mm-hmm. talked about the pressure, only that it was a privilege to be a part of this program.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that you could be somewhere else and not have this great experience.
Right. Was there, as you developed these things, was there a particular written or documented set of the values of the team? This is, you know, this is what Morristown Girls Lacrosse stands for. It's these five things or these two things or whatever. Was there some document like that?
We didn't have, you know, a top five list of this is what Morristown Girls Lacrosse is all about, but we definitely had every year we sat the team down mm-hmm. preseason, as I'm sure every team does, you know, and we went over our expectations for the season. And I, you know, if I can, I don't have them with me right now. I have some paperwork, but mm-hmm. I would say that the expectations were always, you know, to win and uphold that winning tradition.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're a varsity program. You're this is what your goal is. But then in addition to that, it was always, you know, developing yourself as a player and feeling good about yourself as a team. And one of the things we always said was have fun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're not having fun, why are you playing the sport?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that was a huge part of our program as well.
But also, too, I think it's really important that kids want discipline mm-hmm. and kids want goals. And the one thing we always talked to them about was winning championships.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the championship, winning, you know, we would win, let's say, sectional championships. We would win group championships. And it never seemed that we were satisfied with that. It was the end game was winning the tournament of champions.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that motivated these kids to bring it every day on a consistent basis to be the best, not just for the games, but for practices.
Yeah.
And so, again, it was the upholding of that tradition, but having goals, what we thought were realistic goals. And if they weren't realistic, we weren't going to change those goals. Even if we knew that we had teams that may be going through a weaker spell, because, again, back to your point of public schools, you have ebbs and flows of talent.
Mm-hmm.
We never ratcheted back the goal. We never said, okay, going into this year, we're good. We'd be lucky if we win a, you know, South Jersey title. No, we told the kids, no, we're going to win the tournament of champions. And this is how we're going to do it. And this is what the work that you're going to have to put in to get the job done. And they bought in. And mm-hmm. I think that's critical for developing a culture.
Buying in is a huge part of a program. You know, regardless of what we're teaching, what we're saying, they have to buy into it. They have to say, yeah, we're all for it. We're ready to run through that brick wall for this team. Like, this is what we want to do. This is what we want to accomplish. And they were there. They were all in.
And so why do you think that is? I mean, how do you create that kind of buy-in?
You know, success breeds success.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
they can look at those who came before them.
Exactly. You know, we've said it already that they didn't want to be the team to let the program down or let the streak down or the tradition down. You know, they wanted to uphold it for those that came before them and for those that are coming after them to leave that legacy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it wasn't really so much as us saying, this is what we have to do. They knew what they had to do. They knew what they wanted. They've seen it since they were little girls, you know, mm-hmm. watching this team when they were younger, coming to the games and watching those girls that they idolized. And now it was their turn. So, you know, the program fed off of itself. Mm-hmm. I honestly believe that.
You know, one of the first things when we sat down prior to deciding that we were going to coach together, I distinctly remember sitting down at the kitchen table saying, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this right. And the one thing that we were going to promote was we wanted those young kids that were playing youth and rec lacrosse to want to be a part of this. Mm-hmm. We would go down and speak to the kids down at the fields, the town fields, and talk to them. We couldn't wait to coach them. We would go to basketball practices. We would go to sports that correlated real well with lacrosse and try to, you know, inspire those kids to, hey, come on out for lacrosse. You know, your skill set, your athleticism would translate really well to playing for Morristown. And so, and then at the end of the year, Deanna always ran clinics where hundreds of kids would come over to the high school and she would introduce those kids to our players. And then we would make the players go out and individually run stations with the girls. Hmm. And
also during that time is where at each station, the younger kids would hear one of the cheers that we would do during the games and they would learn it. Hmm. So by the time they even got to high school, they knew some of the cheers that we would do on the sidelines.
Very cool.
You know, I think other teams thought we were crazy sometimes for mm-hmm. the cheers that we would do. Like, you know, even when we were winning by a lot, it was just part of our tradition. Uh-huh. People probably didn't like it too much. that was our team.
Uh-huh. I remember reading, you know, again, I'm fascinated by long-standing dynasties and coaches and teams that are able to sustain that over a long period of time. And in the college ranks, granted, again, they've got recruiting advantages, et cetera. But, you know, I watched some of what Nick Saban has done with Alabama football and the stretch of success that they've had. And I've heard him talk about not playing the competition, but rather playing to their own standard of excellence, that they were all about, you know, winning every single day, every single play, being the best they can be. And I remember seeing times where I've been around the high school, and, you know, after perhaps a dominant victory by the women's lacrosse team and seeing them afterwards working on things because it wasn't good enough. Tell me about that.
Well, it definitely happened. Mm-hmm. I can't deny that. You know, we demanded the best from them mm-hmm. at all times. We expected high intensity, high level, high pressure, every practice. You know, the harder you practice, the easier games would be. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, there was a lot of opportunities where we were playing teams that were not as strong or talented. And you get into those kind of situations and teams tend to play down to that level. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for us, that was unacceptable. So even though we may still have won a game, and it sounds so crazy when I say it now, 17-1, there was something that wasn't good enough.
Yeah.
And we knew we had to keep working hard because that next team that was coming up was going to be a really, you know, very tough team to play. So we wanted to keep that intensity up, that level up. And if you're not playing up to your highest game level, then we're going to stop you after that game, and we're going to run you through some things. Mm-hmm. And we definitely did it. And I don't think, you know, looking back, maybe the girls hated it, but I think they know it's why they were so good. You know, if we demanded it from them, they demanded it from themselves as well.
Yes.
You know, they expected to play at a high level, and they understood that if they didn't, we deserve to, you know, to keep working at yeah. it or work a little bit harder.
Well, I mean, from my own perspective, I think one of the things that great leaders and great coaches do is they help, whether it be players, employees, or others, to perform at a level that they might not have thought they could do themselves, to raise, right. you know, if we just allowed each person to do what they thought they could do, there's more. We're all capable of more. And I think the best coaches and the best leaders pull out of us more than we thought we could do. They help us to be the best version of ourselves. So being that demanding, I think, is a tremendously valuable thing.
Yeah, I don't think there was ever a time where we ever asked these girls to do any more than what we would have asked of ourselves. And now, while it may have been different from a physical standpoint, the commitment, in other words, giving that commitment, because for us, we would go home and it was 24/7 for us. All right. And so we were all in for making a commitment and getting back to, you know, making the kids do things on occasion when we didn't play up to a a level that was expected. It didn't happen often, but there were times when we would, after a victory, as the other team was walking off the field, we would put the kids on the line and make them run sprints. Or yeah. maybe we would have another 15, 20-minute practice. And, you know, distinctly, I remember overhearing the other coaches tell their girls, well, maybe that's why they are as good as they are.
Yeah.
Again, it was rare, but it was well, on occasion you have to send a message.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I'm as I hear you talk about the things that you did and the girls went through, I often laugh about this, but I often think if I was a girl in Moorestown, I would have loved to have been on that team. I love being in that kind of environment. I would have loved that. Beyond lacrosse, these girls must have learned so many important life lessons that they carry with them well beyond athletics about performance, about challenging themselves, about commitment, about dedication, about what discipline looks like. And that's what I want to talk about more in our next episode, the impact of your leadership on the players, not just on the field, but off the field as well. We'll be back next time with part two of my talk with legendary lacrosse coaches Deanna Knobloch and Casey Knobloch.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders in all walks of life. To book David for your next event or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of CultureWise.